Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Grey Leopard Code with Gary Norris Gray. Gary will be coming to you each Saturday, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, talking sports live on GLC.
I'm good, Gary. It's nice to hear your voice again.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Have any sports questions, ready?
I don't. This is Dr. Beverly J. Hutton just checking in with you.
Oh, what's up, what's up? Dr. Hutton, yeah. What's up? Beverly, what do you think about this Deshaun Jackson thing?
Deshaun Jackson?
Yeah, what do you think is going on out there?
I really can't speak to it. I just think that all professional athletes have a responsibility to the public to display good character. I don't really know a whole lot about his situation, and I'm sure that the media doesn't really give us all of the details. I don't think that the public is really privy to all of the details. I just wish the brother well wherever he goes and hope that he understands the impact that he has on youth.
Well, my thing is the Philadelphia Eagles are a professional organization. The Philadelphia Eagles know their players. Why would you out a player when you know this thing troubled me because this is typical Philadelphia. It's typical Philadelphia because this is not the first time this has happened. This happened with other players over the years. So I begin to wonder what is going on with the Philadelphia organization.
I can't speak to it, Neil.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you came to the park, number 400. It's a great day for the game of a goal. I'm glad you come in. Also, you're an educator, innovator, moderator. What do you do in the American education system today?
What do I see is, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
What do you see as we can improve the education system in America today?
I think that the public education system is under siege by big business. I do think that this issue of personalization and cultural competencies by school teachers and school leaders is an issue today. I don't know that we've really taken enough time to understand that all children should be celebrated, all children can learn. And if we will respect what they bring to the table, just like we expect them to respect what we as adults bring to the environment, I think schooling itself would be a lot more effective. And that's not an indictment on teachers or principals, because I was a teacher and I was a principal. But I do think that school leaders are responsible to create a school climate and a school culture whereby every student is known and valued and every teacher is known and valued. So if that cycle is perpetuated the way it ideally should be, I think schools would look a lot different and we would see a lot more success stories. Although I don't want to say that public education is failing. I'm a product of public education. My children are. So are you. And the public schools are not failing. I think that some of the accountability systems are unreasonable, but I think that we could certainly do better in the area of personalization and creating a school environment where children feel welcomed and valued.
You know how public schools got started? This is I read this week about how public schools got started.
I can't speak about public. I know that we pretty much operate on like this agricultural model, and I think that particular model is irrelevant right now. But I think we're moving away from it in some areas.
Well, that's how public schools got started. Back in 1909, 1911, most of the kids in America were working, right?
Right.
So when the law, when the Children Protection Law passed in 1911, the kids couldn't work anymore. So that's how public schools got started, because all the inner city children were basically Italian, Polish,
immigrants.
Irish. That's how public schools got started. So people need to read the history of public schools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here we are at this time where I believe that every child has a right to a quality education, no matter where they live.
And right.
And I think that we as public educators could do well to remember that. But and understand that education is not just a right. It's a it's not a privilege. It's a right. And everyone deserves to be there, and everyone deserves to get the best that they can get. And the teachers that are there, we need to be able to hire quality candidates as well. So it has it's really a continuum, Gary, because we could talk about teacher preparation programs. We could talk about entry into the profession. We can talk about the kinds of professional development and support
right.
that teachers need when they're there, and then to understand the children that come and appreciate them.
Well, we got to introduce yourself before we start. We got to introduce who you are and what you do.
Okay. My name is Dr. Beverly J. Hutton. I am an educator of – I worked in the public education system for over 30 years, and I am now working as the Director of Professional Development for the National Association of Secondary School Principals, whose headquarters is in Reston, Virginia. There are 25,000 members in the Secondary School Principals Association, and we represent them on various levels – advocacy, professional development. Those are the major two areas.
What do you envision for disabled students in America? See, because when I was in school, before I went to Burlington City High School, I went to disabled school for 6 years.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And in those 6 years, this is the thing about the East Coast and the West Coast. The East Coast has a philosophy of separation until you're able to enter school. West Coast, they call it immersion. In the immersion program, disabled kids immediately go into regular school immediately. I have pros and cons about this. The pros are in immersion. The kids will get social skills. But East Coast, you are separated from the disabled community. You're separated from the regular community until you're 11, 12, 13 years old, which retarded your social skills in interaction. Now, when President Bush as No Child Left Behind Act, all the states had to conform to the West Coast form of education called immersion. New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut refused to do so. I don't know why, but those four states do not want their disabled kids to come and immerse in regular schools until they're physically able to do so. Well, some kids, disabled kids, will never get into our regular school because they physically can't do it.
But you know what, though, Gary? I remember when schools were separated like that, but now with IDEA, No Child Left Behind.
Yes.
There are so many interventions, and see, back then when you were separated, when we were younger, the education wasn't always equal in both facilities.
No, it wasn't.
There was a difference in quality, but there's not a difference in quality in the two environments now. Even though I like the I think immersion is the best way to go.
Yes.
But then there are times when public school setting doesn't necessarily have all that is needed. We don't have all the bells and whistles that we have to accommodate every child all of the time. So I can see both sides of it. I don't think seclusion is ever the way to go.
I gotta tell you the story.
All right, go ahead.
I got to Berkeley. right down Delicate Avenue. I saw an 11-year-old kid in a motorized wheelchair. I said, wow, look at that. I was shocked because in the East Coast, you didn't do that in the East Coast. Right, in the East Coast, you only got a wheelchair if you were mentally mature enough. That's the West Coast, East Coast philosophy again. This 11-year-old kid riding down the street by himself in a mobile wheelchair, right? I was like, wow, look at that. I was amazed. I mean, can you imagine being a productive 11-year-old riding in a mobile wheelchair?
No, I couldn't because I hadn't seen it before.
I was the only there. Yeah.
So they were really more progressive than
yes.
than the East Coast.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, the issue of African American students. What could we do as a community to improve their grades and improve their standing in schools?
Their what in schools?
Their academic achievement in school. How can we help African American kids in school?
I think some of the structures that we have in public school education are not sensitive to the different structures that are reflective in the home life of some of our students of color. I was participating in a panel a couple weeks ago in D.C. because the president announced my Brother's Keeper initiative, which is the initiative on educational excellence for African Americans. And I sat there and I listened to students, African American students, some very high achieving, some not so, talk about how they didn't feel welcome in their schools, how they didn't feel that teachers had high enough expectations of them, and they didn't feel that they had enough social service support. And they talked about how wraparound services in the school environment with counselors that were culturally competent and sensitive to their life context and structures was what they thought they needed to feel as though they could succeed. These kids were asked for high expectations and were telling us that we weren't giving it to them in their school environment, that they felt that they didn't have to reach. And then when they did reach, they didn't have enough support to stay, to maintain the academic structure or the academic excellence, if you will. You know what I'm saying?
I hear you. I have other guests online. If the guests, Eric and Michael and I think you're all right now.
Yes, I'm there. Yes, brother. Hey.
Again.
What's happening, Gary?
What's up, Jim?
How you doing, Eric? You have any questions?
You're doing good.
Hi.
Hi. What's the lady's name?
Beverly.
Hi, Beverly.
Hey, Beverly. I didn't get a chance to hear all of it, but from what I was gathering, I wanted to throw into the pot the reality that teachers back then had a stake in things. They were high on their own levels of proficiency and whatnot and being able to teach kids, and it mattered to them. I am, from a New York standpoint, I'm probably from the last generation of public school kids that had a decent education because I had decent teachers. And we see not necessarily a lack of quality, but we see teachers' hands tied because they're co-opted to a curriculum that they're forced to, you know, impart on the kids instead of opening up and giving the kids more to think about. And you got programs like music programs being taken away and art programs being taken away. So it doesn't foster a proper environment for kids to learn because they don't want them to learn.
I'm going to push back on you on that because
please.
I find it very hard to believe that a teacher who's sitting in front of students every day does not want them to learn. I do understand that this whole accountability on issue on testing and just making sure kids can pass a test has just taken too much precedence. I think it's too much of a priority in some areas. We want kids to learn math and English, but we also want them to be well-rounded citizens. And I
don't disagree. My issue with this is the fact that basics aren't being reminded as a foundation to use this for teaching. You know, kids are, when's the last time you heard a class where kids are being taught multiple multiplication tables and all the other things orally without calculators or any things like that? I agree with you on basics and stuff like that. My problem is they want them tested to
right.
be essentially automatons. They don't want them to have any kind of spiraling of any sort of artistic bent that might be stimulated by, you know, being able to clash or pair cymbals or play rhythm sticks or anything like that, or find out whether they have proficiency for art, because, you know, there have been so many subjects and studies done showing that kids who enroll in music or who are exposed to music have high propensity of doing well in math and science and other things like that, you know, and it's because of what they're exposed to. If you
mm-hmm.
throw it at them, they'll soak it up. There have also been studies saying that most kids learn everything that they need to learn by the ages between 4 and 9. So you
mm-hmm.
immerse them with this stuff, and they're into it. We have to have not just the teachers. I'm not trying to beat on teachers here. What I'm saying is that administrations are doing damage as well. You know, special needs kids or kids who are in special ed programs, it's like combat pay to some of these teachers. They don't look at it the same way. There's no pride in it, and they look at it as just another day, and they just kind of go along with the program instead of trying to make sure everybody understands that they need to be included into the overall mix as well.
Can I chime in here? Can I chime in real quick, Mike? I totally was 100% with Beverly's platform on what she mentioned when she went to the Brothers Keeper referendum webinar, what have you, in terms of what the diagnosis was from the young people and their lack
sure.
of support and
mm-hmm.
the lack of support they're getting in their home life, and how academic achievement is something that needs to be honored but needs to be supported, not
mm-hmm.
only in the school environment, which it totally isn't, and haven't dealt with it out here in the California public schools as a coach and
yes.
as a parent who had to clap and had a child transfer to another school under the No Child Left Behind process, in terms of if one school's not meeting your academic needs, then another school needs to. And there was a platform where teachers all came on board, and they all chimed in where they felt like the African-American child could not naturally achieve, that they had no connectivity to them, had no understanding of how to teach them, per se.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that so many of these schools, which they call slip-and-fall schools in these upper
yes.
frustration communities, were just given a platform for failure of really no
mm-hmm.
intelligentsia. So as
mm-hmm.
far as creating the arts and creating the curriculum, which charter schools do, which have a higher propensity for succeeding our children, but where the public school systems are not really providing these per se, it's because of the fact that so many teachers that I would deal with would be shocked when I would show up to campus to talk to a teacher, let me know I'm on 24-hour call. You can reach me at any time. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's no idea. They were like marvel. Well, wow, that's amazing. We can't tell you how many times we don't get return phone calls, how letters go unanswered, and how these young people just get caught up in the system. And a lot of times where children who would only reach an academic standpoint so they could be academically eligible a lot of times.
Yep.
So, well, you know, I can play sport, but that's a low majority. But there's not enough creativity involved for those individuals out there who want to create that platform for academic achievement. So I agree with 100%, and I agree with your platform in terms of what you need to provide within these curriculums to create,
mm-hmm.
create a different type
of role.
You're right, but you know, but what I'm saying to that point, not, you know, I'm not countering anything. I'm just saying the reality of what takes place is closer to what in the current educational environment to what Beverly's talking about being in that environment is what, okay, well, let's start with what we need on the grassroots level with you individually.
Yes.
What can
yes.
we do to you based
right.
on what we're going to have to teach you, not what we can be able to fund later. We can do a lot of these things with the arts. I can meet you on the side. I can get you entertained.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the greatest factors that these young people have in terms of what they have with their technological advances and what they're able to ream themselves where, you know, I used to lug 20 books out of a library and sit there with the Dewey Decimal System to try and find this all at their fingertips. So these teachers have these platforms where they can create these studies and these theses per se to really improve that. But with the real striking point, in which I really concur with from what I was able to achieve with, again, young people who had no modicum of success, you know, in terms of the environment. Well, you got a lot of talent, coach, but these guys here, they really can't perform mentally, you know. And then we were out poisoning these, you know, so-called rich schools. You know, and I was dealing with children, you know, young people who had no parents, you know what I'm saying, you know, who were definitely what they were calling that socioeconomic system of what they would call support, you know, human assistance support, another fancy term for welfare. And these young people were out poisoning, you know, these so-called people that had every advantage allegedly to them. Then you become that particular target. Like, what are you putting, what are you instilling? But it all started with me asking, what do you need to succeed?
Oh, I agree. I agree with both of you. I mean, I believe me, I'm not arguing with you.
No, I'm not being contrarian at all.
No. My issue with this, and I'm only saying this because it's been so long, and it's been in the system for so long, because we've already had a platform in which this could be dealt with, and it goes back to the lottery system. In 1976 in New York State, they instituted the lottery system, partly because they wanted to destroy policy and some black economic impact with that, but also because they were going to supposedly fund education through a lottery system. In the early days, the commercials used to say at the end, proceeds to benefit education. So, okay. The lottery's been in existence in New York State almost 40 years now. So you would have thought by now there would be no shortage of band instruments or school sports uniforms or pencils or anything like that where they would indicate that your crime broke. Because
so you're talking about the education syndicate, the ones who are distilling the loot and doing the trickle-down effect of the money. Well, yeah, I hear you on that, you know, and there's no control factor. But what these warriors do, because my mother was a school teacher for years, man, in the inner city in Elizabeth, New Jersey, right? And she would go in there, and she was so old school in terms of teaching. You know, I have, you know, she passed not too long ago, but I have all her reviews, and they're, like, stunning in terms of, you know, the ethics involved in reaching out and making sure these young people were in self-expression and the no-nonsenseness of doing it. So what I was speaking to per se is just what can you do at the grassroots level in that classroom based on this Brother Keepers program than what we can do with the corrupt trickle-down effect of these syndicates who don't let the funds get to where they need to get to.
I have a question for Beverly. This question, I've been thinking about this for a while. Are the parents of these children really, really, really getting into the school of their children? What is the percentage of parents when it comes to educating their children? And how involved are they?
I think that parents need to always be reminded that they are their child's first teacher. And the values that they put on things transcend into what their children think about certain things, and that they need to, at number one, push excellence. And if they can't or if they don't, I would say the school system has a responsibility to instill confidence and passion and passion for students by caring about them and creating environments that are personalized. And I also think, and I have it from two ends, I think that parents should advocate for their children. I'm telling you, as a public school administrator and teacher, I had more parents come to me who want to be their child's friend and want me, as a school person, to be the bad guy.
But that's when babies make a baby.
And I wanted to be partners with them. And I still say every parent has the right to be a partner with the school and to have a voice into how that school is managed and or led. Every parent has a right to have a teacher call them back when they call them. But parents have to reach out. It is not the school's responsibility to raise children. It's the responsibility to partner with parents to raise children. Now, if children don't have parents who know or have parents who are really doing right by their children, then we need to step out and step up and provide wraparound services for them. But parents need to understand that schools can't raise your kids. We can't do it. I mean, I did it for 30 years, and I loved every minute of it, but it was a challenge.
Yeah, baby, one thing that you really like and the one thing that you really can't stand about this whole situation?
With parents?
The one thing that you really love about education and the one thing that you really don't like about education.
One thing I really like about education and runs around I don't like, is that what you said, Gary?
Yeah.
Yes.
One thing I really like about education is the I'm talking about public school education.
Yes.
Is the opportunity that we are given as educators to make an impression on kids, to help them understand that they have something very special. Each one of them has something unique that they have been given, that they should be contributing to the citizenry of this country or this world, that they're not just parts of this very little small community, that they're a part of a global community, that they have something to contribute, and they should all be known and valued, and whatever their gift or talent is should be encouraged. That's what I like about it. I like that I had the opportunity every day to do that, and I used to say to my teachers, I don't know what job that you could ever get where you have an opportunity to positively impact a life every single day. And I counted it as a privilege, and I used to encourage my teachers to count it as a privilege as well. What I don't like about public education right now is that there is so much emphasis on testing and accountability and looking at PISA scores from across the world, which are not really accurate about. Well, there's a lot of good things going on in public education. We don't herald it. We don't sing those songs loud enough because there are so many other disparities in other areas, and it just looks bad. But what I don't like about it is the fact that there's so much emphasis on testing that we're really not looking at students individually. We're really not celebrating the good things. We're just looking at these numbers. And so the numbers, what the tests say, is starting to control curriculum. It's starting to cut out all the arts because what's tested is what we're emphasizing, and we're overemphasizing those things, and we're not emphasizing the personalization part of how important really kids are.
And is that due to No Child Left Behind? Is that correct?
Yeah. I think it started with No Child Left Behind, but I'm going to say I'm not a proponent. I don't like No Child Left Behind. I don't think it really did what it was supposed to do. However, what No Child Left Behind did, it made every single person connected with education look at every single subgroup. Once we disaggregated that data, you had to look at every single kid and every single demographic. So special education students couldn't be pushed to the side and not counted in the numbers. African American males couldn't be pushed to the side. Latino males couldn't be pushed to the side. We had to answer and publicly report how every single subgroup was doing. And that's a good thing because it showed some things that we were refusing to look at as a profession before. We were saying, my school's doing well because all the high flyers, you know, all the high numbers kept our numbers, our averages well. But when you look at every single demographic, we had to say, oh, my gosh, we're not really addressing the needs of this group or that group or this student or that student. So No Child Left Behind, while it got on my nerves and still is getting on my nerves because they're really not doing it, we're not doing enough to change it rapidly enough, it made us look at every single demographic, and we weren't doing that before.
Right, Beverly. It created a format of accountability, yet what the other science and caveat to the No Child Left Behind concept is it's almost something that's on the legal books that parents don't know how to utilize. Because they don't really look at these pictures.
Yes.
You walk in with me, Beverly? Because they don't really look at
those pictures. We didn't spend enough time educating parents.
That's my point. I understood that because, you know, I had to use it based on an athletic transfer that wasn't athletically motivated. You follow where there was going to be an eligibility issue per se with leaving one school to go to another school per se, and I said, well, no, this is academic. This is an academic transfer, and it was based on the fact that I felt that what this school offered, to Mike's point, in terms of the arts, in terms of creative designs, in terms of an overflow, things that create endemic neuron growth academically and mentally was being offered at this other institution that wasn't being offered at the current school. And I was able to utilize that in a counter argument against a section commissioner. You know, this is the second largest section in the state of California after Los Angeles County, where I dwell, where they have a lot of power per se, and they try to control these movements of, you know, people trying to get an athletic benefit. But I used the No Child Left Behind concept, received all the statistical data of all the what the school was providing, but I was able to utilize that because I was informed. Most parents don't understand the power that they have and the accountability they can hold an institution to by virtue of that law of how it was created. But
you're absolutely right about that.
You follow what I'm saying? And what happened with administrators, unlike yourself, which I like how you spoke on it, was the fact that administrators weren't too quick to have parents be endowed in that or to hold seminars at the school or auditorium to show, listen, we have a No Child Left Behind concept. This is how you can utilize it. You can put my feet to the fire, because parents usually go to school, especially in our communities, in a suppressive position, thinking the school has the power, not understand that they have all the power.
They do have all the power. They absolutely do, and I think that we as educators have a response, just like we have a responsibility to children, we have a response. Ability to parents. It's a community. It should be with all stakeholders involved, not just this school being the whole keeper of the knowledge and the boss, you know, the boss of the whole thing.
You're doing my way or not, but they're right. And that's what the No Child Left Behind was utilized. It was utilized as a concept like, listen, we have to hold accountability to these individuals because they're using power. There were situations that were transpiring where I was talking to a principal one time, you know, again, this is where I was coaching. And he said to me, you know, he said, hey, he was predicting futures of young people. And I was just highly optimistic that what he was seeing was not going to be their particular future. And the fact that it was such a power of knowledge of dealing with young people so many years, you felt like if you held back, you know, this particular information or didn't, you know, consort this particular grade or didn't offer this, you kind of fast-tracked the person into a lifestyle that they were going to have based on the fact of seeing it so many times within the inner city. And I was really disappointed to hear that because I thought that was just really bullied by pulpit because these young people were being oppressed. And I mean, I was counter to that particular point, you know, like, hey, listen, you know, it's optimistic. They have a way to go. We need to be here to provide people. So there was a lot of individuals within these positions who were just continue being part and parcel for creating this thing wholesale demise of creating, you know, subpar individuals who had a lot of talent per se. And that's what Mike talks about. Well, one way to offset that is through the arts because it activates certain parts of the, you know, mind that can get a certain particular level. So, you know, go ahead, Mike, man. I just wanted to, you know.
Yeah, no, Beverly, I just wanted to let Beverly know. It's like I am so happy that she was able to do what she's doing out there.
Right.
But there was a different paradigm of what was going on in New York, which is why I was so upset. You know, when they started doing the concept of school boards in New York City, in theory, it was a good idea because, you know, you're, just like you guys imply, you're allowing parents to be more interactive. Well, once the parents realized how much money was going to each of the school districts, then the corruption started in it because they wanted a piece of the action. They didn't give a fart about the kids getting money for the school books. The money was going to go to them. And
but you know what? You cannot legislate integrity.
Exactly.
In every single profession, there are people who are just not working above board. And unfortunately, you know, it's just a sin when you think about that as far as how it holds the future of children.
Exactly.
For people to want to be selfish. But, you know, I can't even defend it. It's just like I love the education profession. I live it. It's a part of who I am. But guess what? There are good teachers and bad teachers. There are good people and there are bad people. And there are people like us who are whole system accountable and can make it rise to the top. You can never ever fix the whole thing because you can't legislate integrity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of the heart. That principal who was speaking ill or not really having dreams, really dreams for kids, should be ashamed because somebody dreamed for him. Somebody
That's
dreamed,
exactly right.
dreamed
Correct.
For me. And we have to be the change that we want to see wherever
Beverly,
we are.
I don't mean to interrupt because I got to go, Gary, but I got to ask this question to Beverly because it's been bothering me for a while. Beverly, you've seen what's been going on in different states. kids getting handcuffed at 5 and 6 years old.
Oh, yeah.
You know, certain states literally having a pipeline where these kids come out of kindergarten and go into the joint. You know,
oh, yeah.
That was definitely not in the
right.
script, but I just wanted your vibe on that and whatnot and just how you see that manifesting itself on different parts of the country.
Well, let me tell you this. I was just involved with this whole White House initiative on supportive school discipline,
mm-hmm.
because the report that just got released, Arne Duncan just released this, and Eric Holder just released this
mm-hmm.
report like about maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, that the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Education released this report that is verifying exactly what you're saying, from preschool all the way through 12th grade, that the disparities in discipline disposition for students of color, in particular brown and black students,
mm-hmm.
Is just, I mean, it cannot be denied. It is now at the top of the national conversation around personalization, because this report was just released, and the you know, you can't argue with the numbers. The numbers are clear, and there are, and you can access this, because before the Office of Civil Rights used to collect this data from every school across the country, and they used
mm-hmm.
to just keep it for themselves. But now it is public. You can go on their website, and anyone can download it, and you can see exactly in which states are, you know, the worst the worst offenders of this. And
mm-hmm.
now that this is in the public eye and at the top of the national education conversation, this whole issue of supportive school discipline practices that are eliminating these exclusionary practices is going to be at the forefront of the conversation for a few years to come. So is it real? Yes. Does it happen? Yes. Do I think that the fact that everyone, there's another report coming out in May from the Council of State Governments, who worked with the Department of Justice and the Juvenile Justice Commission around this whole school-to-prison pipeline. And I think that it's happening. I think
mm-hmm.
that we'll see some real concrete steps from the Department of Education and from this White House initiative to those concerns. And I don't even want to talk about the states that are worse perpetuators of it.
Right. Well, what the numbers reflect quite clearly is that it's no longer a conspiratorial mindset to say these situations are just downloaded and they're just a fact of matter of creating a program
mm-hmm.
for this criminal justice empire that we've talked about on other previous shows, and how this is a paradigm of how to create this particular profile of individuals, and is predominantly African-American males, which is predominantly the target of these, and the numbers and the disparities is absolutely out of control.
It's mind-blowing.
It is. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's, the disparity is just really something that angers, would anger anyone per se. So, yeah, I appreciate you for, you know, validating that.
But there's going to be some more program structures and some more mandates, and this conversation is not going to go away. I think it's going to get better, but the difficult part of addressing it and what we're still grappling with insofar as how to provide training for schools and school leaders into how to deal with the issue, because the issue of implicit bias is a very difficult issue to speak about in front of your faculty. We've got to put some professional development programs in place to address the issue using the numbers, with some ways for people to be able to understand that we are all a part of the problem, and
mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to get up in front of your faculty and say, listen, these are the numbers, and we're not treating these kids right because we're biased. You can't do
mm-hmm.
it that way.
Well, it goes back to the sterility of everything you're talking about with the testing, because I know for a fact that there was a school, junior high, I was told by a spouse of a vice principal at the time, where they had an eraser party, where they would do these testings at a middle school and had all the answers to the testings, and they would spin and take all the tests from the people who took tests and change the answers.
Well, that's
and erase
cheating.
Them, you know, for the testings, and black out the right spots so they could get the proper funding and look like they were not functional, so they would not go on a state education list for poor performance.
Right.
the same thing that took place in Atlanta, right, in the school district where they all got popped and people went to jail for that, where they were taking these, you know, these testing mandates that you're talking about that
yeah.
gave these profiles, and they were doing these eraser parties. I don't know what they called it, eraser party for this person, where they were
yeah.
just taking these tests and erasing these standardized tests and blacking out the correct boxes, and that was how they spent their entire week in administrators.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, I want to know. Beverly, can you come back? Can you come back again sometime in the future?
Sure. You know, you can call on me anytime for anything.
Yeah, we can go. We can go another hour on education, and I love you, Kevin, today. My 400 show. I'm glad you made it special today. I'm proud to be on.
Thank you so much. I love you, Gary.
Give your details, your name, your date, all that kind of stuff.
Contact info.
Go ahead.
Me, Beverly, you mean?
Yeah.
Your contact info.
Oh, a contact info. Okay. You can reach me. My name is Dr. Beverly J. Hutton. You can reach me at HuttonB@NASSP.org. I am the Director of Professional Development for the National Association of Secondary School Principals, and I provide professional development. My department provides professional development for the 25,000 members of our association across the country.
What I'd like you to do is come back next week if you can. If you can,
sure. Next week I will not be available. I'll be at a college board conference presenting.
Okay.
In Los
Angeles.
Oh, you know what? Maybe I can next week. I'll be in
okay.
L.A.
Well, I'll call you. You call me.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll be in touch. Hey,
okay.
Gentlemen, it was very nice meeting with
Likewise.
You and exchanging with you, and I look forward to an opportunity to do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you
all,
man.
Stay well.
Good job.
Bye. God bless you guys.
Thank you. God bless.
Take care. Love you, dude.
Love you. Bye-bye.
I have somebody uneducated in the East Coast. Give us some dialogue on public education and what we can do to improve it. Thank you very much, man.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Okay, folks. We're getting to sports. And the latest news in sports. This Deshaun Jackson thing is bugging me. It's bugging me more ways than one. Deshaun Jackson was let go by the Philadelphia Eagles. Deshaun Jackson was accused of being a quote-unquote gang member. Gang time. Now, if I don't love the Eagles, I'm asking, where did I get my information from? Number two, if you're a blood, if you're a Crip, you would not be wearing anything red. Okay, John Jackson wears red all the time. So they're holes. There are holes in his scenario. If I was Deshaun Jackson, I'm getting ready to sue ESPN number one and the Eagles for never making a character. I'm also really upset with Stephen A. Smith. Knew what he did yesterday in the interview, right? The way he interviewed John is a disservice to our whole industry. What do you say, guys?
Go ahead, Mike.
We lost Mike.
We lost Mike? Oh, okay. Well,
I got a couple more guys. I got Robert and Gary online. Robert and Gary, come in later after Eric. Eric, you go first.
Oh, okay. What's up, fellas? I look at it from the standpoint that what we talked about earlier on, you know, Michael's show in terms of, you know, affiliations. You cannot make a blanket assessment on the individual in terms of who and what they relate to without proof of evidence of any kind of any formats. We did not see any forms of photographs of DeSean Jackson being with individuals who were affiliated with various sects. And what we've talked about in the past, if there's an assessment of someone coming out of South Central Los Angeles of having those individuals who have known to have what I like to call set affiliates, what urban media, modern media likes to call gang affiliations, there will always be individuals you know who have affiliations towards particular groups. But to say that DeSean Jackson's performance seemed never to be affected on the field by any of his personal friends, the relationships, nor did any of this amount to anything other than just a blanket negative assessment and to dramatize an individual who was above board as a player, but because of so-called alleged personal relationships, put the Eagles in a detriment for a team that we talked also on Michael's show earlier, Soul Tree Radio, that had a head coach, you know, named Andy Reid, who had two sons, you know, who were affiliated or slinging drugs. One went to, you know, went to prison for slinging drugs, and upon release from prison, maintained a paid assignment with the Eagles as a special assistant to his father. And these people were dealing within the community, and there was no resolve on that. It just shows the utter hypocrisy of what the Eagles are doing and the slander and defamation of character that you articulated, Gary, in reference to DeSean Jackson.
Well, also, you have a head coach, Jim Irsay of the Indianapolis Colts, who got arrested for DUI. Now he had a whole caseload of drugs.
Illegal pharmaceuticals, yeah.
And like, wait a minute. You want to go out to the John Jackson?
That's possession, correct.
He dies, and you won't even say a word. Don't say boo about Ray Irsay driving under the influence, who could kill somebody but driving his car. This whole thing, this snake right from the beginning. And I'm going to tell you something. If Richard Sherman did not say what he said, this would still be going on. But Richard Sherman put a stop to all of us with his great essay. I love his essay. And, you know, what Richard Sherman did is that, look, this is where we grew up. Do we have friends that are gangs? Yes. Or do we play with them? Yes. Do we do crime with them? No. And the Seattle Seahawks, they get it. The Philadelphia Eagles, they don't.
Well, that's correct, because you had a receiver that now seems to be the go-to receiver other than DeSean Jackson and Riley Cooper, who's on videotape basically stating that he's ready to fight every nigga in the concert at the Country and Western festivity he was located at. And allegedly he went to some kind of human sensitivity training, which, you know, turned out to be probably, you know, the local bar in a Pabst Blue Ribbon beer or whatever, you know what I mean, to try to detox him from the situation. Yet this same, you know, individual talks about he wants to clap on every, you know, every end in the spot, you know what I'm saying? And
yeah,
yet DeSean is from, you know, from an area, which we talked about Chip Kelly too, you know, real quick to bring up today. Chip Kelly, as the head coach at the University of Oregon, you know, recruited primarily in the state of California. 90% of
university,
you know what I'm saying? Yeah, 90,
yeah.
Nike U, Oregon U, correct. And 90% of that, yeah, or yeah, Nike, I'm sorry, Phil Knight, yeah, Nike University, a.k.a. University of Oregon Ducks football. And he coached and he recruited heavily in the state of California. All his prime athletes, the brother that played in Snoop Dogg's league, right? Snoop Dogg's the running back, you know, I forgot his name escapes me, played in Snoop Dogg's football league in South Central L.A. Now, Snoop is known to having some affiliations with groups down there. Did that affect Chip Kelly from recruiting these athletes for the University of Oregon, which came from these areas. He spent a whole bunch of time on Crenshaw Boulevard, Wilshire Boulevard in Southern California recruiting these athletes. You had the NFL level, DeSean Jackson, who also played in the Pac-12 at University of California, where Kelly coached. I'm certain that if DeSean was still at California when Kelly was the head coach, I don't know if they crossed paths at that time frame.
He had
the familiarity. They did. Okay, so he knew about DeSean when he played against DeSean. So now all of a sudden, you know, he has 1 year with the team and things went a certain way and the Eagles had some success. And this guy has averaged almost 20 yards of reception, 17 for his career. Now it's a problem because of his affiliations off field. I mean, come on, this is utter hypocrisy.
Wait, Eric, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you what it is. John Daddy said, I want my money. I want it now. And the Philadelphia Eagles are one of the deepest minor teams in the NFL. And when John Daddy said, I want my money up front, I knew what was going to happen. I know when.
So they start playing Ice-T's Color CD the moment that happened, huh? You know, the moment DeSean asks for his money, you know, Philadelphia starts like colors. They start bumping the beat for Colors. I got you. They start playing the soundtrack.
The Eagles have done this time and time again with Terrell Owens. Donovan McNabb, okay, Randall Cunningham, same thing, Randall's out with my money, where do you end up? Minnesota, okay, this is a replay over and over and over again.
They gave the money to Riley Cooper.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you something. The Eagles are in trouble. Now, you know why they're in trouble? Because Michael Vick, who was the peacemaker of the team. Now, when Michael Vick went to New York, guess what? They had no peacemaker. So what's going to happen in that locker room this fall? Right.
There's a lot of hot brothers in there, you know, Shady McCoy and them cats. You know, they're not really feeling, you know, the direction, and they're almost being ostracized, wondering who's next. And so they've got their wake-up call of how that operation runs, as well as a whole lot of other brothers who, you know, in the NFL who think they're riding with them 100% based on performance, when at any time they can say, well, you've got an affiliation, you know, you're dealing with this particular set, per se. And these organizations, and these media organizations who make these statements and literally have, you know, so-called artists from hip-hop wearing their tats, wearing their colors. You know what I'm saying? They have these individuals come on, and all of a sudden, you know, they're saints because they just want the numbers of their audience, you know? So, again, you know, it's just sheer chicanery, hypocrisy, scuttlebutt, you know, skullduggery. It's just all of that, you know, combined.
I'm going to tell you, Eric, the Eagles are in serious trouble. I really believe this because what's going to happen is the first week of practice, they're going to look at Riley Cooper and say, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? And the brothers didn't like what he did last year. And Michael smoothed it over. And now he's gone. Oh, now he's going to bring him to the locker room.
Yeah, now they got to see DeSean, who alleged by the Eagles or someone in their organization who said he had Crip affiliations, play for the Redskins.
Thank you.
Brother's going to play for the Reds. Cincinnati, the Washington Reds.
I don't use that word on my show, but I get you. I get you.
He's going to play for the Washington Reds. The blue.
Robert, you there?
The Reds kin. The kins are the Reds. The kins are the Pyrus.
Robert, are you there?
Yeah, Gary, good to talk to you.
Put the pie, brother.
Yeah, that was great. I really appreciated hearing Beverly and the conversation before. That was really great. So I'll call in next time she's on, because I definitely wanted to talk to some of those issues next time. But, yeah, the whole Deshaun Jackson thing, I mean, this thing is getting more and more, you know, surreal by the minute. I mean, it's like I watched that interview with Stephen A. Smith or whatever, and so Stephen asked him, he said, you know, whether he was in a gang, and he said no, and then he said, you know, do you believe that the Philadelphia Eagles, you know, put this information out about you?
Yeah.
And he said, no, I don't believe that, which really surprised me to hear him say that. You know, I mean, I don't know sometimes where any of these athletes, you know, why they, you know, they have all this money, but why they do not invest in somebody to talk to them about how to come across when you get into a national media spotlight is beyond me. Because,
well,
you know, this poor guy,
I feel sorry for him. Let me address that. 30 years ago, these kids were going out of college and going out of universities without getting proper etiquette. Well, the University of Illinois invented a program in public speaking, which every school across the country is copying now. So now you need that come across very eloquent. If you look at interviews back in 1970s, football players, basketball players, hockey players, you can see the difference between the interviews now and the interviews 30 years ago.
Yeah, the only thing that surprises me is that, you know, number one, that he is not indignant about what just happened to him. I mean, because regardless of what he thinks about the whole, you know, what his situation is now, and I'm sure he's probably relieved to be, you know, back with another team or whatever, especially in the division. But why is he not angry that, he didn't do anything wrong, and all of a sudden he's shipped out, you know, essentially fired for no cause. And
right.
You have your employer telling the national media surreptitiously that.
I hear where he's coming from, and sometimes, you know, you have to kind of bridge the gap, because it does seem somewhat ridiculous that someone who allegedly is in an area of refinement, makes a certain amount of money, there's supposed to be a compensatory conduct and polish that comes with that when talking to media. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, but I think he did come across very polished. I mean, he was.
And
very,
he is. And
he
I think what happens is the fact that he does not know.
Yeah.
He does not know. I mean, Deshaun, in fairness, may have had some relationships and some friendships with certain individuals who had certain alleged affiliations that he may not be publicly proud of. At the same time, there's a diversion of not wanting to out and down your relationships or make a communication about them per se, or at the gravity of what they're really into. He doesn't know that maybe some of the consorts, what the gravity of what their relationships is. Do they have film? Were they involved in certain things? But he knows he's had conduct with individuals who can per se have an affiliation per se. So there's also the brevity of endorsements, the brevity of getting your future contract that you have to be considerate about. So there's a gray area you cross. So actually the answers he gave were the best answers in that particular situation. He didn't clap on the Eagles per se, but we do see that where DeMaurice Smith, other NFLPA, is looking at an investigation what actually took place. And that's how you have to let it go in that particular environment, because you can get swallowed up. So in fairness, it may not have come across for the best public answer to individuals and how he can honor these particular statements. He did go to Cal Berkeley, so we know he wasn't just sitting in class not doing any level of participation. You know,
no,
so we do know he has an intelligentsia. But there's a fine line, and there's a diplomacy you have to play, especially when you're dealing with what can be perceived as a slick interviewer.
Yeah.
Also, the fact that America to this day does not like an angry black male, right?
No, yeah,
if John Jackson came on the air,
he could have played to the gang stereotype.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think he has to be angry. I don't think he has to be angry. But I can't believe at no point, at least from what I've read, I've seen a lot of the media reports, the ESPN coverage of this from the beginning. You know, at no point have I ever heard him sort of get up and just say, this is unbelievable. This is, if let's look at this situation here. Here's an all-pro receiver that, you know, the community clearly loved, the team clearly loved. You know, everybody, you know, saw as the most explosive player on the team. And lo and behold, somewhere between, and they gave mass, you know, big contract money to, so clearly the team saw him as a part of their future and everything. And somewhere between then and about 9 months later, we have a situation where this team is willing to just give this player away for zero and, you know, is calling and is surreptitiously telling the media that he's affiliated with gangs, he doesn't like to work out hard, you know, he's a troublemaker in the clubhouse or whatever. It's like, where did this disconnect happen? I mean,
well, the burden of truth now lies on the Eagles because that's where the weight is now coming. It's not really coming on Deshaun anymore.
No, agreed. Agreed, but what's so unusual about this is that, you know, now the union is stepping in, and the union, rightfully
yeah,
so.
Well,
the union is stepping in and saying,
The union hasn't said anything on this.
Well, Michael, this morning the union made a statement. This morning on the news report, they're going to investigate what went on in Philadelphia.
You know, I know, Gary, but look how long that took. That took over a week. You're sitting there letting this kid's character get assassinated. You know, Deshaun Jackson was working on behalf of the Eagles, sponsoring anti-bullying. Now, how hypocritical is that? That
right.
He's going to be affiliated, but yet doing work on behalf of the organization that says he's a cancer by sponsoring gang bullying efforts, or rather anti-bullying efforts, on behalf of the Eagles. He's representing the club when he does this. So how much of a cancer could he have possibly been?
And Michael, to your point, he has an education foundation with reading, with dealing with young people as well, where he goes into the inner city as well. So yeah, to your point.
Yeah, I just find it. I mean, the other point I just wanted to make too. And this might seem really trivial to a lot of people, but it certainly isn't to me. And I think this is one of the dumbing down things that's happened across all national media in this country. Watch that little crawl across the bottom of the screen, whether you're watching CNN or you're watching ESPN now. That thing runs 24/7 now. It goes right through the commercials oftentimes. And if you watch it today like I did when I was running on a treadmill for an hour, and yeah, all I see repeatedly, I must have seen it at least 8 times over the hour that
the
I was
loop,
on that
yeah.
damn thing. You know, that, yeah. And the quote was from just Deshaun saying basically that, you know, yes, I know people in gangs, or I have friends, you know, or associates who are in gangs, but I don't, whatever he said, something to the effect of, I don't hang
unless
out with them.
Unless they're doing negative things, he doesn't mess with them, right.
Right. If they're doing negative things, he doesn't. But the whole implication of that, then, is that, well, there's some good gangbangers out there, and there's some bad ones, which is a total load of horse crap, of course. You tell me one gang is doing a lot of good things out there for the country.
Well, the majority of these people associated with what is called gangs, but on the West Coast, where Deshaun descends from, and where this is, they're called sets, right? Sets means groups, and they come together for different reasons. The low minority are alleged gangbangers. You know, cast on the streets are not those who are out there putting in work, which makes you a banger.
Thank you.
Well, I'll say this: I'm from Chicago, and I got to tell you this. I mean, I don't know anyone in Chicago, black, white, people who've been in gangs or associated with gangs or not, don't know anything about gangs. I don't think there's any perception out there in the community in the Chicago area that there's good gangs and bad gangs. But my only point to this is just that I'm sure Deshaun said that or whatever, and, you know, to make clear that I would never, sort of keep close associates who do associate with people who do, you know, commit crime all the time or whatever. But the point is, they take this little snippet out of all the things that he said over
Correct.
Who knows how long that interview was. I mean, it was, because I've seen many parts of it already, and I still haven't seen the whole thing. But the point is, you sit here and you put this little 8-word clip or whatever in front of people 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times over the span of, say, a week or a month or whatever, and all of a sudden that becomes the reality, and people, and that's all they know about DeShaun Jackson.
Correct.
That's all, all they ever heard about him, you know.
And we're here to say, why they do it, and what the crocus manifestus of that loop does. And we've always mentioned in previous times in the past, you know, I haven't talked to you, Rob, but Gary and Michael and I on other shows, we've mentioned quite clearly that this is looped, that these snippets are continuously looped, where they try to become the new perception of what transpires. However, in this thought process, one has to think for himself. And that's why DeShaun Jackson, in that interview, and why you say, well, why didn't he say this or why didn't he do this? He has no choice but to play that game because he knows what he's up against within that time frame. But then time will sort it out as we go forward with this by virtue of the kind of discussions we have. And it tilts the whole scale back towards, okay, show us the jurisprudence. Who was the rat who made this particular statement? And let's out who would happen. That's, we've seen this happen in the NFL. In the syndicate, in the gang, you know, using that term, of the National Football League, when it happened with the Incognito and Martin scenario, what took place with that situation. And Goodell made a statement that really was incredible to me, you know, after this whole investigation took place, since it's all related to the syndicate called the National Football League, where he mentioned that Pouncey and another person who was involved in that must undergo some kind of medical treatment before they can actually be a participant. Medical treatment?
For
I mean,
real.
You hear what I'm saying?
Gary, hold on a second. Let me throw this in the pot for real, because that's the whole mouse thing I tipped off a year ago with LeBron James. If you remember, after LeBron and Miami won, and LeBron got his ring, his second ring, he said straight up, there's three of you I'm never going to speak to ever again. And we know that they were affiliated with the mouse. And it was because of the salacious stuff that they had been putting out, endorsed by management, that would allow them to continue harping on his brother until he won a title. Now, the DeShaun Jackson thing, the similarity to the same is that the DeShaun Jackson thing went over the top. They went too far. They were endorsed by management to say exactly what they said. If this was a newsroom 10 or 15 years ago, they'd have said, hold up on this.
And to Michael's point, he's 100, because this, I know for a fact that these other NBA players, you know, in my dialogues, have made it quite clear there is absolutely no way in yonder they're going to be talking to a certain cat over there at all who calls himself an African-American brother under any guard, no matter how many references and kiss butts they make to him on air.
We got Raider Nation, Zeke Devin, Raider Nation. Come on in, bro. Raider Nation, you're on the air, Zeke Devin.
Hey, guys, this is Kevin Smith. We went to elementary school together, remember?
I remember you, man. Go ahead. What you got to put it back?
You should remember me. Remember I stuck the paintbrush up your asshole, tucked your dick in the middle of art class? I put a club up my asshole and fingered it, too? Fuck you, faggot. Bitch.
Okay. Thank you.
Wow.
Talk about issues. Now, that's what I mean when we're talking about, unfortunately,
that came straight out of HQ. That came straight out of HQ on one of these networks.
You know that did.
I mean, that came straight right out of one of those networks. My nerves have been
hurt. I couldn't get them all because they wouldn't work.
That's right. Yep.
Hey man, all I can say to the caller, hey man, observe every red light.
For real. Unbelievable.
You're at to pull your pants up too.
Please observe every red light from this point on, Black. It's gonna be quite spooky from this point on. But go ahead, G.
I want to go on with with the Kobe Bryant thing. Kobe Bryant. I had all respect for Kobe Bryant until he spoke about the Miami Heat and the Miami res- like the drill button. I'm wondering. How can you say that as an African American man? How can you say that?
I mean, well, he can say anything, actually. I mean, but does a person do their own self a disservice by making those particular statements? Then obviously sometimes individuals make statements that they wish they probably never had made. And then now you're accountable in this short mind site and internet Twitter-dumb insanity of 140 characters for someone to go out and pretty much make an affiliation on a team, the Miami Heat, by virtual wearing hoodies in support of the racial profiling of one Trayvon Martin, rest in peace, and what took place in the aftermath of all that, and to make a statement well after the verdict and all the hostilities that took place, and the President of the United States sensing that this was a trigger point and having to make a statement about, you know, we're a nation of laws, we need to pump our brakes, because it was on edge at that particular point in a lot of areas. It was a powder keg ready to bust, you know, and that needed to take place because there was a lot of people really upset with the incendiary responses. So for an athlete of Kobe Bryant's magnitude who's starting a new sponsorship of a new line of, you know, supported sneakerwear, this is the Kobe system, what have you, to make an assessment of what another organization's doing and that they're being successful, that they show some conscientiousness, usually points a trigger button back to the person making the statement and what's really going on with them, not with others, you know, but what's really festering inside their own souls and what lack of conscientiousness they may have to real social issues and how they can be really blinded by virtue of how they live their life and how they're celebrated daily and how every day on media, you know, hey, if anyone can come back from a double amputee ankle, Kobe Bryant can. You know, I mean, you hear these men. If anyone can come back from a lobotomy, Kobe Bryant can. He'll get 50 points. If anybody can come back from 2 years in a wheelchair, Kobe Bryant can. You know, they can pump all this, you know, vestive crap, you know, over and over again that it gets looped into their psyche that they feel like, you know what, I can say anything based on what I'm hearing daily. So I don't give much credence to that particular point. It was just not a good moment in Kobe Bryant's, you know, career, something that will be recycled over and over again. If it's truly how he feels, you know, then, hey, more power to him, because that really shows a really lack of personal depth. If it was, you know, a misquote or he just absolutely screwed up and, you know, was taking it a wrong way, then – you know, you're entitled to that, but I didn't give much precedent to that other than the fact that it was a real ignorant statement and it seemed real embittered towards another organization that wasn't a fresh statement.
Let's see if we get a much calmer call from New Jersey this time. New Jersey, are you there?
From New Jersey? Hello, Gary.
Jersey, yes, you are. Yes.
Unfortunately, I heard that misdirected.
It happens every 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay, and I'm glad that you have finally made a decision to handle it well. I want to congratulate you on 400 radio shows.
Thank you.
I can say that I am proud because I am your mother. And I'm so proud of you today, and that not only did you do 400 radio shows, but you are close to 400 articles
that you
have written for Black athletes. Keep up the good work. Encourage somebody else to pick up the mantle and run on with it. Train somebody else to do the work. Okay, because you're not going to be around forever.
I can do it. With guys like Eric and Michael, I can do it.
Okay, but and also the people that you have met as a result of having been an author, Annabelle Jester has been tremendous, and I want to thank them too for supporting you and encouraging you along the way. That's all that I have to say today.
Thank you very much. I hope you get better. You get stronger every day.
Oh, you do. Yeah. You do. You all do. Right. I've seen the change in your writing, the increase in the vocabulary. The semantics have been improved along the way. And I've watched you, not critically, but just watched you grow. And each time, each show, I hear, look, just keep on going, baby. Okay?
All right.
Love
all right,
you.
There you are. You're good, good, good. All right. All right.
Love you. Take
you too. Yeah, you're up. Yes. All right. That's Jersey. Yeah, like old folks in Central Jersey. Eric.
Yes,
you're
sir.
You're 32, right, Eric?
Yeah, I am. Jersey Shore.
All right. Well, I'm right by Philadelphia, right there.
Okay, a little further south. Yeah. Yeah, you know, back, you know, quoting Tupac Shakur and Snoop Dogg song in the theme of what we talked about before, nothing but a gangster party.
That's all it is. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Anybody out there who wants to get in, call 646-727-3319. This is Grandpa Cove, number 400. Grandpa Cove, 400. And hope we can do 400 more. We'll see about that. Eric,
yes, sir.
What can we do to change Major League Baseball? I got to the point now where I can't watch the whole game because they're bemoaning these guys who are good players, but they're ignoring the Latino and Black players in Major League Baseball. It's getting beyond serious now.
Yeah, it's a tremendous disconnect these days. I remember, I think it was, the Oakland A's a few years ago didn't have one brother, a Latino, on the team or one African-American-born player
right.
on their opening day roster or Houston Astros or somebody. I can't recollect which.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
It was
Athletics?
87 players in the whole league.
And
the Houston Astros, the Oakland A's, and the three teams that didn't have African American on their team.
Okay. I had two of the three. I don't recall the third, but, I remember the A's of the 70s, man, with Campy Campaneres and Reggie and Blue Moon Odom and Vita Blue and, Bill North and those brothers, were putting in work. And so, again, the part, there's been all these long, drawn-out stories about how there's been no African-American golfers to follow Tiger Woods, and now there's the baseball fields in the inner cities have all dried up. There's no support. There's low participation in the little leagues, and they put together a consortium of players like Dave Winfield and some other brothers, good brothers to go out and try to instill baseball in young brothers and sisters. But, when you look at the HBCUs and you look at some other colleges, they're staffed with a bunch of brothers and sisters playing baseball, in the collegiate ranks.
Right.
You definitely see, in Latin America, obviously Cuba, but now there's been a huge influx of Asian ball players coming in, from the leagues getting paper, this, that, and the other. So in terms of the participation, you've had the two-sport athletes that, like Bo Jackson as well as Deion Sanders and now Jameis Winston. I know he's pitching down there for Florida State, and, he was a top-of-the-line player. So there are some participation amongst brothers, is it what it used to be in terms of the development for major leagues and what the minor leagues are producing? I don't know how many brothers and sisters, brothers, that is, are playing baseball in the minor leagues. I know there's no sisters for the record, but there's no brothers playing in the minor leagues in terms of the development levels coming up. And, you know, baseball's changed well because, you know, in states like Florida, for example, they have year-round leagues, you know, with the touring leagues. You know, in some ways in California, they play year-long. A lot of these individuals who show athletic gifts are now playing, you know, basketball and football because they've moved to year-round sports. So I think if you look at it from the curriculum in America, the three-sport athlete is such a thing of the past where, you know, a person would start the fall season and play football and winter season play basketball, then move to baseball or track. Come spring, you're not seeing that as often, you know, in terms of the participation because the sports have become so specialized. And a lot of that has to do, which gets underrated, not only with the fact of building baseball fields, because there's still if I go drive through T-ball fields a number of times, I see a lot of African-American parents, and Hispanic parents out there with their young children playing in these leagues, you know, all the time, how it sorts out as they go forward with the equipment and the participation, because young people show other interests in other sports. And baseball doesn't have the attractive appeal to these particular communities, and that's been by design as well. It's on a real stealth level that they've been able to weed out and make this America's game, quote-unquote, a certain style. And then what we do see with the Hispanic players, especially recently with the exception of what took place with Balco, is a large consortium of players from Latin America who are getting caught, you know, in the roid issues and the steroid usage, and we've seen the manipulation that was taking place in the Dominican Republic with ages and birth certificates per se, where that's not really taking place in the European American community, where these players are coming part and parcel and being developed and being brought up at an abundant number. So there's a reason why these things are transpiring other than lack of participation. It comes back to support, and it comes back to who you want to see play in these particular leagues. And it's definitely disenfranchising people like myself who enjoy watching baseball in the 70s and watching them brothers get down, you know, when, you know, the Dick Allens, the, you know, the George Fosters.
Right.
Brothers, so like, you know what I'm saying, the Strawberries. And we talked about in the past when Strawberry was an outstanding after Daryl Strawberry and Eric Davis, you know, both these players are MVP caliber players. They both came out of South Central Los Angeles with a ton of other brothers who also would have been referenced as those who had affiliations. You follow what I'm saying? And that's been like the last influx and last class of what I consider a consortium of brothers who came through Southern California in a prime baseball area that went on to play Major League Baseball and chose that over other sports. But they formed their own leagues right there in the inner city. They had lookouts. They did a lot of great things. So there's been some cultural things that have taken place in America that's disenfranchised that participation.
Well, do you think that Budgeting has been here too long?
I don't even know what he does, you know, other than
he got a good contract.
They have great TV contracts, so and they're still getting excellent support at the turnstiles. They do get great participation from the fan base, you know, so they're doing well in those areas, even though it's highly televised. They have these huge television contracts. They have their little network, per se. They've created these world baseball festivities. But they've been reaching out to India, Australia, and other places, you know, to try to create another training grounds for ball players. But I haven't seen too much other than, say, the NBA. I haven't seen too much of Major League Baseball Africa. Have you?
Not at all. You know, they have only two BAD games. One in Compton, California, one in New Jersey. That's it.
Right.
All the other baseball games are in America.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened in Oakland, you know, with Ricky Henderson, right? You know, when he came out of there and he was groomed in that particular Bay Area, you know, Barry Bonds, obviously, was an offspring of a professional baseball player, so that looked like that was going to be the route he was going to particularly follow. So the talent's there, the development of the talent, the identification of the talent, the nurturing of the talent, what you need in a particular sport, just has not manifested. So to say that, and plus the specialization of sports, you know, in terms of being a three-sport athlete, it's not looked upon. Coaches frown upon that. Basketball wants players year-round on the prep level. They have all these national high school basketball championship tournaments, AAU. Football has 7-on-7 leagues, quarterback training, quarterback specifications. They have receiver skill position camps. So players are just really specialized, and they're using baseball as maybe it's a something to do. And a lot of times the baseball programs, I know some in Sacramento, aren't really properly funded and properly supported. One where Shaq Thompson in high school, that I used to coach at Shaq Thompson, he plays for Washington State, Washington University of Washington football. He had signed a contract with the Boston Red Sox. Never played high school baseball. He may have played a little. I don't know if he played much, but they signed him to a contract. Of course, he took the money because obviously they're going to give you a contract and give you an upfront signing bonus. You can take that and without losing your eligibility for football. And there was an internet report where he set some kind of record for striking out in the minor leagues, but he had no training, no nurturing. But they signed him anyway to a minor league contract, and obviously he took that on. So a lot of times, with baseball, it's the development of these players from the prep level, not so much the little league level, that's just not taking place because of the specialization. But there's still a good number of participants. They're just not being nurtured and trained to go on. And baseball can be a lucrative career for an athlete. You know, you can play 20 years, you know, Derek Jeter's, you know, Mariano Rivera's, and they have great benefit packages, just per se, and, you know, you do play a number of games, but it is a good, attractive level for pro sports and longevity, and has a low inertia on your physicality where you can go on for a number of years, and it just hasn't been that particular way. It's been taken up, so it's a watered-down product because so many of the best players are not playing. So it's almost like it's retreating from what Jackie Robinson allegedly did in the 40s. It's kind of retreating to the era it was when he actually broke in.
If I had a kid, I would tell him to be a catcher because the best way to get a baseball out is to be a catcher. Go right straight through because they always need catchers in the major leagues.
And yeah, and if you're a left-hander, left-handed pitching. You know, and like I said, you have some speed on you. You know, you can be a 4-2 player. You can develop, you know, learn how to, you know, hit the curve. I mean, the technology is such, the training is such. You have batting cages, whatever, per se. You know, if you've got the skill and the talent, you can manifest. But it's a developed sport. You know, you need gauges and you need role models. It's really, you know, you don't really see a individual player, even at Barry Bonds at his height when he was unbelievable, that 71 home run season that he had. You didn't see much Barry Bonds commercials like you would see in, you know, baseball and football, basketball and football athletes. You know, so the promotion of their stars wasn't there. Then what happened with the steroid era and people being called to Congress, it looked like it was a cheat sport and you had to do these things per se to participate. So there was a lot of distractions with baseball. But again, I think the participation is not as meek, especially as it starts at the T-ball level. There's still excellent participation in little leagues. They still have little league opening days that do pretty well across the nation. It's just that as it goes forward through the high school levels and the development levels where there's a drop-off, not because of dearth of talent, but because of the dearth of development.
What do you think about Barry Bonds going back to the Giants?
Why not? Yeah, why not? Yeah, he came in as a hitting consultant. He'd sure put a lot of money in that, you know, in those seats, and he set some records, and innocent to proven guilty, right? You know, he's had some affiliations to certain things that really have not put him in a, you know, a too troublesome a situation as some other athletes have. So that aside, obviously he knows a lot about hitting. He knows a lot about timing. He knows a lot about pitching. And if he can part his knowledge, he's the son of a former batting coach, Bobby Bonds, is, you know, rest in peace, was his batting coach's yes. dad for the Giants for a number of years. So he obviously has some tutelage. Obviously, Willie Mays, his godfather, was someone who trained him. So, yeah, Barry Bonds wanted to teach someone about hitting, man. I think they'd have a line from here to Albuquerque, man, trying to get some of that into wisdom. So I think that's just a smart decision of asking one of baseball's greatest players of all time and one of its greatest hitters of all time, most patient hitters of all time, to come in and impart some of that knowledge on Giants ball players. So, yeah, I think that's a, you know, it's a wise decision by the Giant organization.
Okay, who are you picking? Florida, Kentucky?
Final Four time, right? Yeah, I mean, I did pretty well in my little bracket, man. At least I was in the top 1% of 12 million participants. I like the UConn. You know, I like Kevin Ollie, what they did. They beat Florida early on. Kentucky, Wisconsin, you know. I mean, so you're asking me to pick a winner? You're asking me to pick a national champion who's participating?
Okay, let me know. I'm picking Wisconsin
okay.
and Florida. Because I don't believe that Kentucky kids are ready to go yet. I think they have one more year.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it's a coin flip. Kentucky's a hot team right now. You know, he found a gem when Willie Cauley-Stein, Kentucky Calipari Center, Willie, you know, John Calipari, the coach of Kentucky, found a gem when he brought Marcus Lee off the bench, you know, from North California, from Deer Valley High School, Gary, you know, representing where we are, you know, up here in North Cali.
Yeah,
he had a great game, you know, coming off the bench. I mean, Kentucky, you know, is in a situation right now where they're just playing free. You know, they were rated number one. They had that quote-unquote top recruiting class. And Calipari has done some excellent coaching. You know, he does get a lot of knocks that he rides his talent, but he's done some excellent coaching. They're a hot team. Wisconsin is steady. You know, they can make plays. You know, they can play free and loose. They're well-disciplined. Kentucky, you know, has not only athletic factor, that they have a hot factor right now, a can't-lose factor, been there, done that factor. So I would say they have the momentum in that particular game, but I wouldn't be surprised if Wisconsin won, but I think Kentucky can edge them. In the Florida-UConn game, I think that UConn has all the grit. They play like they're playing for a meal. You know, they don't play like they're, you know, they're playing like if we don't perform, we can't eat. You know, and they had a lot of momentum and favorable by going into Madison Square Garden, basically a home game for them.
Yeah.
When they went there for Big East country from back in the day when they were a Big East powerhouse. So Michigan State just looked a little too overcoached in that game. They didn't play free and loose. I think Florida's a better team than UConn, you know, and I think that you know Florida should win that. So it looks to me like an SEC final potential, you know, between Florida and Kentucky. I think Florida should win. I think Florida might win. I think Florida will win it all based on where it is right now, but anything's possible. I think Florida's just too strong, too deep, too tough across the line, and too steady in terms of how they play. They're just really a relaxed, senior-laden team, and they look real strong.
Do you watch the ladies game?
Yeah, I do. I enjoy the ladies.
You know what? I think you might see, for the first time, you might see two undefeated teams going against each other for a championship game.
That would be nice. I would really like to see that. I mean, Gino Auriemma, head coach of UConn, I mean, what, is this his 50 millionth undefeated season or so? I mean, he's just done. You know, I mean, this guy gets no love for his accomplishment. I mean, would never put together what Auriemma has done
as a
coach. I mean, he, you know, what, has had 3,012 game winning streak since he's been at UConn. It looks like, you know, I mean, it looks like every time you look up, man, they're like 49-0, you know.
Yeah, there he is again. It's like,
yeah, I mean, I like his style in the sense that, you know, he. I seen him in an interview. It looked like he said, "Man, we need to win. We need to win." He was talking like a guy that was off a 15-game losing streak,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
He really meant that. So he's wired for what he does. Phenomenal success as a coach. I think he would definitely be someone, regardless of the fact he coaches women, I think that's irresponsible, of someone who is definitely worth, you know, listening to philosophies, schematics, game management, and how to be successful. I mean, he's done that. Notre Dame is undefeated. Unfortunately for Notre Dame, I think they lost their best player. You know, the young lady who was their top player was hurt. So if they meet undefeated, I would definitely want to see clash of the undefeateds, but I think Notre Dame would be shorthanded. You can never be shorthanded against UConn. So it looks like Geno's about to get his, you know, 912th national championship. So.
No, actually, Geno will die a bad summon.
Okay,
eight.
Well. Yeah, Pat was a tremendous coach in terms of wins, and, you know, Geno just stacks these undefeated seasons one on top of the other. And I know a lot of people say that has to do with him playing in the Northeast, but, you know, the Northeast has risen. Even though Maryland's a pretty good team, Tara Vanderveer is an excellent coach for Stanford. I think, you know, they have something to say to, you know, give UConn a challenge, so that won't be something to sleep on. I know that Stanford stopped their all-time winning streak at one point in time, so... It's a nice Final Four. Maryland's won a national championship in the past with their coach. So, yeah, I enjoy the women's Final Four. So I think it should work out well. Obviously, you like to see the two undefeateds, but I sure would have liked it better had Notre Dame's top player not.
Well, I think that if UConn can stop a Wilmergate, they will win. But if
back to the men's.
If he goes crazy, watch out, they got UConn.
Yeah, I mean, what success, for a small state, University of Connecticut, what success that, you know, when they start off in October, ready to for the season and preseason and start training, getting ready to play, that you would have, again, from that school, two basketball teams from the same school on the Northeast in the Final Four. I mean, that's really impressive what they've done basketball-wise under Calhoun and obviously under Gino Auriemma at that particular university. I mean, yeah, arguably, based on national championships over the last few years, combined between men and women, they would be the top basketball school in the nation.
I'm very happy with the young coach.
Kevin Ollie?
I'm very happy with him.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, Kevin's done it. Kevin's he had a special coaching year. Longtime NBA journeyman, you know, and obviously he has the players buying in and they're playing well and they're playing with the system. But one thing he has them doing that is the proof positive of a coach, you know, they play hard every single time out, you know, and they play tenacious and they play clean, they play aggressive. And they play with a sense of refinement in that form of aggression. It's not a loose, rough, coarse aggressiveness. So, yeah, he's done an exceptional job molding that team, and they believe in it. But yet, at the same time, he has X and O skills.
I wanted to ask you, the NCAA Gangster City.
That gangster party, yeah.
Gangster City. Gangster City is moving toward a 5-conference or 4-conference scenario. I need it because what happened in here is the Missouri Valley Conference had Creighton in their conference. Creighton said, "We're getting out of here because we can't get paid, right?" Now,
right.
Wichita State, who were undefeated, they're talking about leaving Missouri Valley next year to go elsewhere in the Big 12. See, the small conferences are gonna lose teams year after year after year because the NCAA won't do what it's supposed to do. So yes, let me say this. 20 years ago, Louisville members of the Northern State, Northern Illinois, were all in Missouri Valley. They're all gone.
Right.
And this is going to continue until they stop the bleeding.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the realignment of putting these teams and positioning themselves for the best financial deal, the best coverage that can help their budgets out in terms of recruiting, in terms of exposure, and basically the bottom line. Because what happens so often is that each time a team, you know, has success, especially basketball is their king. That's why it's on five different networks, the March Madness scenario, that's where it is. You know, the three quarters of the world population online has a, and I know I'm, you know, just being sarcastic, has a March Madness bracket, you know what I'm saying? You know, so that's their moneymaker. I mean, that's the landslide moneymaker. And what happens so often, too, in this tournament, that every time a team advances and wins, it's more money to the conference. It's more money to the university. And there's another caveat to that, and that is enrollment always goes up based on exposure. So all these Final Four teams will see an increase in enrollment based on exposure because it's the greatest marketing tool to have your university. If a person is divided, and these are non-athletes who are divided between, well, should I go to UConn or should I go to Lehigh or should, you know, say in the Northeast area, or should I go to Rutgers? Well, yeah, I want to go to UConn. That looks like fine. You know, they got teams in the Final Four. It looks like there's some real student events. And the team's always in the Garden. It looks like some great socialization and great networking going on. You know what I'm saying? So these are just tremendous marketing tools for the universities.
HBCU, no chance.
Amden University,
2 years ago, the NCAA told the Amden Lady Pirates, you gotta play outside your conference. They did that. And you gotta win your tournament game. They did that. And, okay, now you gotta win your tournament. They did that, and they gave him a 15 seed. See, this is a gainer, man.
Right. I mean, hey, you know, that's why I say it's like, you know, calling the kettle black. All right, you know, I mean, it's nothing but a gangster party, man. You know that, and. You know what I'm saying? You know, nothing but a gangster part. And what happens with, you know, those institutions, I did see a glimpse on one of these networks of Alabama A&M going against Alabama State for the SWAC tournament bowling championship women. You know, I mean, I was like, who are they poking fun at now? You know, but whatever. You know, I mean, no, it's the budgets. It's the budgets that give you these opportunities to recruit. It's these budgets that I give you the opportunity to hire the best coaches. It's the budgets that give you the opportunity for exposure. And it's well-moneyed and it's well-heeled. That's why one of the for every 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10 seed ever, you know, it is to win opening round games is because they're dealing with a recruiting budget
right.
Where they play these top seeds that dwarfs probably the school's enrollment that they have to compete against. You follow? So it's really tough.
As I say, problem. Who wants to go to Southern Illinois University in the middle of nowhere? Nowhere, because they're 2 hours to go to St. Louis, 2 hours to go to Memphis, 8 hours to go to Chicago.
Virginia Tech is one of those no man places. Baylor can, in Waco is in a weird, Texas A&M in Lubbock is in some real isolated location. Corvallis, Oregon State University, is in a real, like, you know, funny type area, you know. And so you have these locations, but what they have budgets and they have exposures. You know, they're going to play in if you're in the Pac-12 and you go to Oregon State or Washington State up in Pullman, you know, these little isolated locations like that, you're going to play or you're going to be seen on national TV because, you know, the Pac-12 has its own network. You know, you're going to play a national tournament. You're going to either have your conference tournament in Los Angeles, Anaheim, or Las Vegas, and you're going to get national attention exposure while being in the Pac-12 going against teams that are going to produce NBA-level caliber players based on their recruitment, like UCLA, like Arizona, you know, like Oregon. So it pays to be remote if you're going to be those type of players, and you can't really get to the top pecking order of the Pac-12 in terms of those prestigious schools like Arizona and UCLA per se, but you can still play that competition and develop and still get the notoriety. It's worth it. So that's part of being that particular conference. That's what happened to Creighton University by being a Big East school in Omaha, Nebraska.
Right.
Now, people are having troubles with geography already, right? They're struggling with geography. You know, if you ask these people, you know, where Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Tulsa is, and they'll tell you, a lot of people off the street, Tulsa, oh, isn't that, you know, a county in Canada? You know, I mean, they have no clue to typical geography. Now they're calling the Big East school a team in Omaha, Nebraska. Providence to win that game just for the sake of Big East pride. How can you have an Omaha team beat a true Eastern team? But it's the contractual obligation. It's the exposure. It's the budgetary refinements. It's what you have to do to compete. It's what you need to do to recruit. And, again, like you said, gangster, 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 because it all comes down to what they can get money-wise, man. Hey, Gary, ain't nothing but a gangster party. We'll connect. I got all your coordinates. You have mine. You know, I haven't been on the radio shows and doing things. I've been in the lab. A lot of different eyes in the fire that, you know, I won't articulate on. You know, that's the style. Hey. But, yeah, we're going to connect soon, man. You know, I've been able to come up for a breath of air. That's why, you know, I dialed in with Soul Tree today and dialed in with you. Hey. I may catch up with L.A. and the other brothers later, but I have been really, like, I had to go into the laboratory, G. I had to go into the bat cave, man, and completely, you know what I mean, concoct some new projects, man, you know behind the scenes, man, that people are currently benefiting from nationally unbeknownst to themselves.
Could you give both your contacts and what you're doing?
I mean, I nuked my blog because I was telling too much truth out there. It was becoming under fire. I moved on. I can be found at ericgsatterway.com with the metaphysics of hoops. Also, you know, back in point, we're affiliated with Black Athlete. Got some other projects working on that I'll unveil as we go forward. But that's really it. Anyone want to contact me direct? I do get that. It's esatterwhite@AOL.com, esatterwhite@AOL.com. You want to reach out. You know, I will get back to you. Get a lot of influx of mail, but I will get back to you. And that's just pretty much the coordinates, man. But it's springtime, G, so, you know, I'm back from out of, you know, hibernation,
all right,
man.
I'm back, G.
And yeah, so we can chop game, man. But, again, you know, before I bounce out, which I'm getting ready to do, congratulations on show number 400.
Thank you, Rob.
Tremendous honor for me. This is on the one and on the strength to be a participant today, and to be able to share some viewpoints, man. You know, and help you know continue to sojourn on. And your mother's phone call really made my day. You know, listen to that articulation. So that was good, man. So again, congratulations, man. You know, it's well earned, well deserved, man. And you're a shining light of example of someone who's expressing the power of self-empowerment and the power of self and confidence, man. So, you know, keep it going, my brother, and thanks for the opportunity to speak on your show today.
Be ye. Thank you.
God bless you, brother. I'll be in touch.
All right. I'm going to go off at 707. Are you there?
Yeah, 707, Gary. I just wanted to get in and get late here.
Get in,
get out. We're almost out of time, but I was listening to your show, but you had such a excellent roster of callers today and such stimulating discussion that I did not want to interrupt that flow, but I did want to call in and add my congratulations also to your 400th show. I have felt privileged to be a part of it and to you know, share by participating and observing the fact what you have done as, to my knowledge, the first so-called disabled host on internet radio with cerebral palsy, and to overcome that so-called disability and to rise to the challenge and carry it on to where you've gotten 400 shows. So everybody I know stands in honor of you and in admiration of your accomplishment. So I'm sure everybody who has participated shares that thought.
707, we got to go 400 more.
400 right. More, well, yeah. Yeah, it's taken a long time. How many years? What, 8 years to get to 8 years to get to 400?
8 years to get 400, yeah.
Well, there you go.
2022. I mean, that's going to be a long way away.
Well, you know how to do it now. I mean, you've built the pathway, and now you just have to follow it. So.
Right. Hey,
as we get to, you know, I know you were talking in depth there about the Final Four. We're creeping up on the end of the NBA basketball season and then heading into the long, long, long NBA playoffs. A couple of observations. Teams that I know you've been following, the Pacers seem to be crumbling, and the Spurs are going remarkably strong.
Yep. I think the Pacers are in real trouble. They're in trouble because what they did at the beginning of the year, I tell people this, you never say what you're gonna do before it happens. And the Pacers said, we have to win the home court advantage to beat the Miami Heat. Well, guess what? They're not gonna get home court. And I think that could be more devastating than to be in second place in the East. I think this is going to crumble and destroy this team mentally than any other team in that conference. They might win the first round when they play either the Raptors or the Knicks. That would be an easy round, but when they go up against Miami again, there will be no contest. They are mentally unraveling, whereas at San Antonio, they're putting it all together. And the problem is, this guy is a genius, because what he does is he rotates. I don't know why people don't do more of this. He rotates his starters. I have never seen a coach do that, but he does it more this year than all the years combined. He has rotated starters, and it worked. So.
Yeah, I've often wondered, you mean, and also resting his starters, giving them rest.
I mean, rotating. No other team does that but them.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah, it seems sort of obvious. What I've been reading about the Pacers is they are sort of collapsing. It's probably similar to what you were saying, but collapsing under the pressure of being the front runner.
Yeah. No, but you don't claim what they did wrong was at the beginning of the season, they said, I need to win the Eastern Conference, and I need to do it this way. Well, that puts undue pressure on you to perform. And when you start losing, it doubles the pressure.
Good point. Let me ask you this. What has been the key for your getting to 400? What was your mantra or your vision that kept you steadfast along the way?
Well, every year I change the format. And I think people need change. So if I get stuck, every now and then I get stuck, you change the how you do the show. In the beginning, I used to do it by section, baseball section, football section, hockey section. And it worked for a while, but then it got to, okay. It's almost 20 years to do that way. So now what I do is, whatever the topic is for that week, for that month, that's the lead story. And that's if we talk about it all hour long, so be it. It'll be hour long. That's what I do.
Okay. Right. Well, as your mom said, it was nice to hear her. You know, the show has evolved and it has grown and it has developed. And I know you're, you know, moving into the area of social issues, disability issues a lot more. So it's not strictly sports. It's how sports impinges on other areas of society, but certainly it has grown. So it's always a pleasure. And, you know, when you started out, Blog Talk Radio was just a voice of the wilderness. Now it, too, has grown. And you really led the way in the development of Blog Talk Radio. You're one of the few shows that has been there from just about the beginning, and you're still on.
Oh, Blog Talk Radio is really gone wild. I mean, they have over 1,000 shows a day now. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, how many were there when you started?
About 40 or 50.
Well, there you go.
And in the old days, you could talk forever. Now you got a limit. You can't go over an hour after your show anymore. Where in the early days, you could talk forever, and they wouldn't stop you. So it's a big difference now.
Well, you've surfed that wave. I know Rhonda Harper is one of your guests about surfing, and you've surfed the wave of internet radio. So I just wanted to get in and get out, and I'm out of here. Congratulations again.
Wait, we got to do it the right way, right?
You got the time to do it. I know you're. I'm looking at your clock. You're running out of time here.
Wait. You got to do it the right way, right?
That's right. Well, it's your prerogative. You don't have to do anything.
What? Say what?
It's your prerogative. You don't have to do anything.
the Master Plan. And we can't forget Doreen Wade, Rhonda Harper, and Monty Wilmont. Of course, the 609 and the 707. Also, Robert from Chicago. And Big E, Eric Delvite from Sacramento. Hope you enjoy the show. Number 400. And hope you come back for 401. 401. On the other side. I didn't get any of the news. We're going to do it next week. Same time. Same station. And I'll leave you with Sunday afternoon song. We're going to do Sunday afternoon, the music box, right before the Michael Lewis Ingram anthology, Mind Dream, on Sunday. The music box comes first. At 4 to 6, West Coast, 7 to 9 on the East Coast. My man Michael comes in at 9 and does his Mind Dream. So we have music from all afternoon and all evening. You can watch TV, turn on the computer. And this is all the good music. And this is what's going to be on this Sunday afternoon. I will be doing the Delphonics, Philadelphia Delphonics.
Thank you. Yeah.